Come to the second chapter, entitled Thus Have I Heard, and the Pali reads Ewang me sutang, ekang samayang bhagava, bara nasiyang viharati isipatane migadhaye, tatrako bhagava, panchavagiye, bhikkhu amantesi. Ewang me sutang, thus have I heard. Following an ancient tradition, all the suttas begin with these first three words, Ewang me sutang. It's a reference to the oral tradition, which says that the person who first heard this discourse was the Buddha's disciple Ananda. Venerable Ananda, however, was not present when his teaching was given. It's believed that when he became the Buddha's attendant, after 20 years in the order, Venerable Ananda asked if he could be present whenever the Buddha gave a talk on Dhamma, and if the Buddha could give him the essence of all his earlier discourses or sermons. Thus, when reading this text, the reader must bear in mind that it is by no means a strictly literal account of what the Buddha said, but something which has been recorded. The reciter is making it clear that what he is transmitting is devoid of any personal additions or interpretations. This is the way this particular teaching came to him, and he is simply reciting it as faithfully as possible. So that is largely true. The discourses of the middle-length sayings and the long discourses, the Digha Nikaya, the Majjhima Nikaya, and many of the other suttas that you find do begin indeed with Ewang Me Sutang, but the other discourses you find in the say the Anguttara Nikaya, the discourse is connected by numbers, say the Book of the Ones, Book of the Twos, Book of the Threes, and so forth, or the Sanyutta Nikaya, discourse is connected by subject. Sometimes they just have the name of the place at the very beginning, and it doesn't begin with Ewang Me Sutang. So just a little correction there. But mostly it does, and the background that he gives here, this is exactly the case, that what we have here is essentially what Ananda recited at the first council. So after the Buddha's Parinibbana, then during the rains retreat following that, when the Buddha had his final passing away in May, the Visakha Puja, the full moon of May, then the Sangha gathered together at Rajgir in the what's called the Satapani cave. King Ajatasattu, who was the king by then, had sort of fixed up the area and made a big, bigger platform and shelter. And the tradition has that 500 arahants all gathered there for the rains retreat after the Buddha's Parinibbana. And then two of the monks were given the job of reciting the essence of the Dhamma and the essence of the Vinaya. And so the Venerable Upali was the one who was the expert in the Dhamma, in the Vinaya teachings, and so he recited all of the Vinaya rules for the bhikkhus and the bhikkhunis, and the whole vast number of training rules, small and large. That was Venerable Upali. And Venerable Ananda was the one who was invited to recite the Dhamma teachings. And the story goes that he had spent so much time being the Buddha's most perfect and astute, careful attendant that he hadn't reached arahantship by the time that the Buddha passed away. And so he was in kind of only an anagami, only a non-returner, as it were. But he'd lived very close to the Buddha for many, many years, but had not yet reached a full enlightenment. And so the story goes that Venerable Mahakasapa, who'd been invited to be the head of the assembly, said, if he's not an arahant, he can't come to the meeting. Now, some people say, well, that was because he was just trying to encourage his dear brother monk. Others were saying that he was just trying to give Ananda a bad time. or maybe he was just sticking to the rules, but he said, no, if Ananda's not an arahant, then he can't come to the meeting. Who else was going to be able to recite all the teachings? I'm not sure, if Ananda couldn't come. But the story goes that then Ananda felt the pressure, like, well, tomorrow's the meeting, and I'm still not an arahant, you know, I've already got to crank it out. And so he was up through the night, you know, doing walking and sitting meditation. And as he saw the pale light of the dawn appearing in the east, as it says, as rosy-fingered dawn painted the sky, then he realized, I still haven't made it. I'm still not an arahant yet. Oh, well. And so the story goes that at that moment where he thought, oh, well, I might as well take a rest because it's going to be a big day today anyway. So even if I haven't reached arahantship, I should at least be a little bit refreshed to handle what's how the day is going to be. And so then it is said that as he sat down, when his feet had left the ground and before his head hit the pillow, he reached total and complete enlightenment. So he is known as the only person who attained full enlightenment outside of the four postures. He wasn't sitting, standing, walking, or lying down. So amongst Ananda's very many unique achievements, that was also one of them. But it's also a very significant element of Dhamma practice in that when you're trying so hard, you got it, I got it, I got it, I got it. You know, it's we're at the fourth watch of the night, and the Mahakas was going to be so mad at me if I don't make it. And I got it, and all that pressure to try and achieve, and having been around the Buddha's presence for so many years and heard all these Dhamma teachings and still not having reached completion, it was only when he sort of dropped back a notch and thought, oh well, then there was, he, in a sense, he let go of that bhava tanha, that becoming, the desire to become, and then with that last little attachment dropped, then all of his paramitas were able to ripen, and he reached full and complete enlightenment. So then, and as one of the commentaries then states, just to prove his point that he had indeed reached arahantship, it is said, allegedly, he arrived at the meeting floating 3 feet off the ground. So he entered the assembly hall, you know, in flight, in full lotus posture, but 3 feet above the ground, just to emphasize. Venerable sirs, my path has been completed. And he had perfect recall, which was a very well-recognized feature of his skills. And so that even though Ajahn Sucitto goes to great lengths to say this wasn't exactly what was said, this is just what was remembered, it is said that Ananda could indeed hear something once and repeat it verbatim. And there are, you know, people in the world who do have that kind of skill. It's also, just as another point on this, Ewang Me Sutang, it gives a very, very different flavor to the Pali canon than you have, particularly with the Quran and the Bible, which are supposed to be the, you know, the voice of the Absolute speaking. This is the Word of God. I think my memories of Church of England services are, you know, this is the Word. When they would finish a reading, it would say, the vicar or whoever was giving the reading would say, you know, this is the Word of the Lord. In fact, I think I even did a few readings in chapel and in school assemblies and such like, this is the Word of the Lord. So what's being said is, this is the truth. This is totally reliable, and particularly the Quran and the Torah, which are said to be, you know, the Word of God in His language, you know, His language, burned in letters of fire, and that this is the Word of the Absolute, and it is absolutely true and totally reliable. So without going into those particular religious traditions, what you have here is a very, very different tone, because what's presented is not this is the voice of the Absolute, but this is what Ananda remembers. So it's right there, it creates a whole different context of, rather than this is something you should believe because this is the ultimate truth speaking, it's, well, this is what Ananda remembers. And so it's in a way offered for our consideration. It's just the way Ananda, who is a trustworthy person, but this is what Ananda remembers. So it's given to us to hold in a very different way, rather than this is the truth and you should believe it. It's like, well, this is what Ananda remembers, so please take it, consider it, and see whether it rings true for you or not. So, Ewang Me Sutang, Ekang Samayang Pakawa Bara Nasiyang Viharati Isipatane Migataye Tatrako Pakawa Panchavagiye Biku Amantesi. Which translates as, once the Blessed One was staying in the deer park at Isipatana near Varanasi. There he addressed the bhikkhus of the group of five thus. All the suttas begin with a brief description of the place where the sermon was delivered. The setting here is the deer park at Isipatana, known in modern times as Saranath. Highly regarded as the place where the Buddha gave the first sermon, it has been a Buddhist pilgrimage site for many years. A column built by Emperor Ashoka, an Indian ruler in the 3rd century BC who converted to Buddhism and did much to propagate it throughout his empire, marks the spot where the first sermon is believed to have been given. And those of you who've been to Varanasi will know there's this huge stupa, the Dhammic stupa, is there. Saranath is located near Varanasi, or Varanasi, as it is sometimes called. Varanasi was a holy city long before the time of the Buddha, and over the centuries many thousands of people have gone there to die. It is considered very auspicious to die and be cremated at Varanasi, and to have one's ashes thrown in the river Ganges. Being a holy place at that time, Varanasi also became the natural resort of seers, sages, and mendicants, as well as people from all over the surrounding area who would gather to exchange views on matters of religious doctrine and practice. This is where Gotama and his ascetic companions had been dwelling until he had decided to abandon the extreme self-mortification and to withdraw from the others in order to practice in solitude. And it was to this place that, as an awakened one, Gotama returned to begin teaching his five companions. Also, Isi is from the is related to the Sanskrit word rishi, or so it's the Pali Isi is like the Sanskrit rishi, like a yogi or a wanderer with psychic powers, and Patana means a landing place. So it's sometimes translated as the abode of the seers or the rishis, but also it's the landing place. And Venerable Ananda Maitreya, who's a very eminent Sri Lankan elder who spent his 70th reigns with us back in the 80s, he said it was known as the landing place of the rishis, because they would come out of their retreat places in the Himalayas, and this is where this is a kind of landing strip. They would land outside of Varanasi in Isipatana, the landing place of the seers, the rishis. The sutta addresses these five as the Panchavagiye Bhikkhu, the group of five bhikkhus. Nowadays, bhikkhu just means a Buddhist monk. Etymologically, bhikkhu comes from the word used for alms, A-L-M-S, alms, like in alms food, and is still used within that context in countries such as India, Afghanistan, or Pakistan, where it survives as the word bakshish, meaning a tip, a gift made as a special favor. If you go to those places nowadays, you will meet more bakshish, or more cries of bakshish than bhikkhus. Anyway, these five were named Kandanya, Vapa, Badiya, Mahanama, and Asaji. Kandanya was the eldest. Many years previously, as a novice Brahmin, he had been invited to Suddhodana Raja's palace, the Buddha's father, the palace of King Suddhodana, along with seven of his peers, to see the baby Siddhartha and to give predictions as to his destiny. They all agreed that this babe would either be a great emperor or a Buddha, although it was Kandanya alone who reckoned that Siddhartha was destined only for Buddhahood. Four of the Brahmins that had been present at the Raja's palace later told their sons to keep their eyes on Siddhartha, as he was destined for greatness. These sons grew up to be the other four of the group of five, according to the stories. The Buddha here is addressed as Bhagava, which means the one who has great fortune, or the Blessed One, sometimes translated as the Lord. The term is always used in a spiritual context by his disciples and implies someone who has both a great deal to offer and the capacity to make it accessible to the many folk. The Buddha, however, generally referred to himself as the Tathagata, or thus gone, someone who has completed the round of birth, finished and gone beyond. So he didn't refer to himself as Bhagava. This is because the Buddha does not identify with any of the qualities he manifests. That is, he regards all these as less important than the fact that he has gone beyond. As a source of inspiration and encouragement for the unawakened disciple, the power of such a living presence of truth in human form as a Buddha cannot be overestimated. However, the Buddha repeatedly emphasized holding to the Dhamma, his teaching, as something that would have a greater and clearer long-term value than devotion to him as the Blessed One. Adoration of the Buddha seems to have been a cause for the long delay in Venerable Ananda's own enlightenment. Now, even though Ajahn Sajita translates Tathagata as thus gone, there's been a debate over the last 2,500 years as to the exact meaning of the word Tathagata. There's a wonderful passage in one of D.T. Suzuki's books where he says, you know, the word Tathagata is completely untranslatable. And then he spends the next 14 pages translating it, explaining it. And one of the things, just as I was saying yesterday about how the Buddha took words and then maneuvered their meaning or altered their meaning, like the word, like the Dhamma Chakra, the wheel of Dhamma. So using the image of the wheel as a symbol of liberation rather than a symbol of conquest. It seems that he was also very fond of word plays and puns, and so the word Tathagata is made of two parts. And if you remember the word Gacchami, like Buddhang Saranam Gacchami, I go to the Buddha for refuge. So Gacchati is the verb meaning to go. Gacchati, a person goes. So Gata means gone. But the A at the beginning, Agata, means come. The A as in Amaravati, Amara means deathless. Mara is death, Amara deathless. So the A at the beginning is a negation. So the word, the second half of the word could be Gata or it could be Agata. It could be gone or it could be come. The first word, the first part of the word, Tata or Tat, means thus or such. So it's almost like our English word that. So tat, T-A-T-H, means thus or such. So the word could be tat agata, thus come, or tata gata, thus gone. And just as with D.T. Suzuki, you know, spending 14 pages trying to decide, you know, what does it really, really, really mean? My suspicion is, and again, second-guessing the Buddha is not a very productive practice. I'll say that repeatedly, but I continue to do it anyway. But my guess is that the Buddha deliberately used it, or created the word. He coined the word, it seems, because of it having a double meaning. Meaning both thus gone, one who is completely beyond, one who is totally transcendent, and also thus come, one who is totally present, absolutely immanent. And those familiar with Western theology will know those two qualities of immanence and transcendence, the quality of presence or the quality of transcendence, are often talked about in terms of considering the nature of ultimate reality. And I feel that the Buddha was deliberately making allusion or connection with both of those qualities, both totally present and attuned to the time, the place, the situation, fully embodied, but also totally gone, totally transcendent. And that in terms of, again, in terms of our training, that's a very useful principle to bear in mind. One of the characteristics that we recite of the Buddha, Vijja Charana Sampanno, the nine qualities of the Buddha that appears in the morning and evening chanting, Vijja and Charana are a pair in that term. So Vijja Charana Sampanno, we translate in our chanting books at the moment as perfect in conduct and understanding. Is that perfect in? Yeah, perfect in conduct and understanding. Or impeccable in conduct and understanding. So charana means conduct. It literally means to go or to walk. Charity. Charana means action or activity. Conduct. So vijja is knowing or awareness. So there is both the quality of wisdom that is perfected, the quality of awareness that reflects the transcendent element, transcendent aspect, and then the quality of charana, or conduct, represents the immanent. So that the Buddha was totally liberated, but he wasn't spaced out or lost in a absorption into the unconditioned, but he was completely attuned to the conditioned realm as well. He was, as in many of the stories and accounts of the Buddha's life and his way of being, he was perfectly attuned to the people he was with, the situation that was he was encountering, And the words that he chose to speak were always appropriate and helpful. So there was an extraordinary degree of mindful attunement to the time, the place, and the situation, so that the Buddha's transcendence and his complete liberation from all attachment and all limitation was partnered. Its partner was also the quality of a complete embodiment, or fully with the body, fully with the material world, the weather, the people, and the social situation. So that it's also significant that that's the word that the Buddha created to refer to himself. So it's a, you know, in a way you could just take the word Tathagata and sit on that for rest of the winter retreat to reflect, what does this mean, what's this pointing to, I feel it's a very important central spiritual principle for us to consider. So I'll maybe say a little bit more about that in a while. Then Ajahn Sucitto starts to talk about the painting, so you can pass the book around if you like, other people could look. So these paintings that he did, illuminating this manuscript. Incidentally, we had just started Chidhurst Monastery back in 1979, and because Lumpur Sumedho found that the Dhammacakka Sutta contained the most potent and essential teachings, he encouraged us to learn that and to recite it as part of our pujas from time to time. And so Ajahn Sucitto, who's a bit of an artist, thought, and had done a bit of calligraphy in the past, thought, well, I think it'd be nice to make up a... We got these sort of photocopied sheets that we've got out of the old Thai chanting book, and they're all right, but it'd be nice to make up a tidy copy for Lumpur Sumedho. Maybe I'll do a little bit of a decorated capital letter on the, you know, the beginning, maybe sort of a nice big E for Awang Meisutan. Yeah, that'd be a nice idea. So that idea of making a neat copy for Lumpur Sumedho then spun out over, as I said, a period of 4 years. So that book, the large blue book there, that's the copy that Ajahn Sucitto ended up doing for Lumpur Sumedho. It's a little bit heavy to read from, but that's where this whole project began. But he ended up creating an illuminated page for each part of the sutta. And so as I read these words out, then you'll have to imagine for yourself, or look at the other book as it's being passed around. But I'll try and describe it. It's also, if you have copies of this book from the library, it's also at the beginning of each chapter, you can see there's the illuminated script there with Awang in the middle. So Ajahn Sucitto describes, around the frame of the painting are some of the beings who revere the Buddha. At the top appears a line of devas, heavenly beings, who are all exclaiming their delight that a blessed one has come into the world to turn the wheel of the law. So that's sort of along here. They look a little bit like pixies, actually, little sort of pointy hats. And so he's got a very sort of Celtic touch to his devas. So they're not totally classical Asian devas. They're also kind of North European pixies and fairies, you know, gliding in there as well, and also Celtic knotwork. Because along with creating a nice tidy copy of the chanting for Lumpur Sumedho to use, it also Ajahn Sucitto was very conscious of drawing upon the ancient Western traditions of illuminated manuscripts, and so some of the most beautiful artifacts that you have from the period of what's called the Dark Ages, when much of Europe was just in a state of local warfares and civilization had sort of degenerated somewhat. The Christian monasteries carried on, mostly in Ireland, but other places in Europe as well, in the north of Britain. And in those monasteries, they created these illuminated manuscripts of the Gospels or other parts of the Bible. Also within the Jewish tradition, you have these very, very beautifully decorated copies of the Torah, and in the Greek Orthodox tradition, also these beautiful old Bibles with wooden covers and very, very highly decorated. Usually the first capital letter of a chapter would be the main feature, but then also the writing would be decorated with little embellishments. So Ajahn Sucitto was also very much inspired and informed by that the Christian illuminated manuscript tradition as well, over bringing Buddhist themes in. But so as I said, the devas sometimes get a little bit European. The little Irish pixies and leprechauns poking out of the foliage here and there. Then he says, down at the bottom are the beings in the hell realms, in states of misery. It is said that in the lowest hells it is pitch black and there are only a few times when it's possible to see. These are when a Tathagata is born, when he attains awakening, when he begins the teaching of the Dhamma, and when he leaves the mortal realm. I think that in my most deluded teenage years, just seeing a picture of the Buddha with that inexplicable but evocative gentle smile and stillness sent some light into my mind. Not much, but enough of a glimmer to consider that it might be worth finding out what he had to say. One day. Maybe it's like that in hell. Hell is depicted in my painting by three animals. The pig symbolizes delusion, the rooster is greed, and the snake represents hatred. The overwhelming presence of these is what hell is. So, and that's at the bottom of the painting there. You've got this sort of bright-eyed human, or sort of big-eyed human face. Again, looking a little like a deluded teenage Ajahn Sucitto, perhaps. Possibly chemically assisted. Around him, there's a pig there, and then the snake sort of crawling across the top, and then the rooster over here on this side. And that's also what there's one or two places in the suttas where when the Buddha is asked about hell, and he says hell is the mind wrapped in the states of greed, hatred, and delusion. The great wheel of the law here is represented by a wheel with eight spokes. This symbol has come down to us from the early centuries of Buddhist India, there being no iconography in the Buddha's time. The earliest symbols used by the Buddhists were the Bodhi tree, with an empty space underneath it, the Bodhi leaf, here decorating the rim of the wheel, the parasol, so that's the kind of umbrella, the shade, a symbol of elevated status, a parasol poised over an empty space or a throne, the special and highly decorated footprints, the stupa, a ceremonial tomb containing the ashes of a cremated saint, and the wheel, which may have been a transformed sun symbol or simply that which is conducive to going places. So these he has here around the symbol these lotus flowers on the corner and then these two hands. The symbols he's describing there, and the ancient Amaravati in southern India, in Andhra Pradesh, you know, there are no Buddha images there. It was this huge stupa and had reliefs carved around the outside of it. So during during the time of his career as a bodhisattva, then he's depicted in human form. Also in the life before his enlightenment, then the stories that are depicted there at the stupa have him in human form. But after the enlightenment, then the Buddha was never represented by a human figure in that era. And as he says, there was a sometimes as a Bodhi leaf, sometimes as the pair of footprints, and so forth. when Tom Hancock was designing the temple here, he'd studied architecture in Japan, and he built the Milton Keynes Peace Pagoda and the Battersea Park Peace Pagoda before he built the Amaravati Temple. And he studied and looked into the iconography of the original Amaravati stupa in India, and he was really inspired and delighted by this absence of human form And also, when he talked with Lumpur Sumedho about this, Lumpur Sumedho said, well, he first heard of Amaravati when he was living for a short time at Ajahn Buddhadasa's monastery down in southern Thailand. And one of the monks there had copied from a picture book of the stupa of Amaravati. He'd copied these reliefs and images from the original Amaravati stupa. And Ajahn Buddhadasa made a lot of this, the Buddha as not being representable in human form, but using these other somewhat oblique symbols of the footprints or the space under the Bodhi tree or an empty chair. And so Ajahn Buddhadasa made a lot of that. So when talking with Lumpur Sumedho, then Thomas suggested, well, maybe we should just have a the central shrine for the temple would just have an empty chair. I mean, a most marvelous spiritual symbol. And at first, as I understand it, Lumpur Sumedho thought, yeah, that's a good idea. It's a really good teaching. That's because people are really attached to the form of the Buddha, and this is from the earliest times. This is the most sort of significant and helpful symbol. But then wisdom started to enter the picture, and he realized, I'm going to have to explain so many times. Every Thai person who comes here, every Sri Lankan person, they go, why is that chair up on the shrine? Why haven't you got a Buddha image? Can I offer you a Buddha image? You know, I can get one made in Thailand for you. You know, couldn't you find one? And so he felt this sort of infinite vista of headaches coming from that beautiful spiritual symbol. He thought, well, it's a great symbol, but. couldn't see himself carrying that off, so that we ended up having the classical golden image made in Thailand. But it does have blue eyes. He has got lapis lazuli eyes, so it's got a slight European touch to it. For those who look very closely, you can see. So then he goes on to speak more about his painting. In my painting, there is a large naga or serpent figure coiled around part of the wheel. So at the top you can see this kind of cobra-headed figure at the top of the painting there. And that sort of wraps around the top spoke of the wheel. In my painting there's a large naga, or serpent figure, coiled around part of the wheel. Nagas are different from ordinary snakes. They're often mentioned in the scriptures as possessing special powers. They are giant hooded snakes who live in the water, but can take on human form and give birth to their young on the flat plains. They then go back to the sea when the land floods. Nagas appear in the celestial realms as well as as part of the retinue of Virupaka, a celestial world guardian who is mentioned later in the sutta. There also seem to be a few ranging around freelance, generally harmless if you don't annoy them, but occasionally needing to be tamed by an arahant. Also, significantly, one time an eminent Thai monk came to visit a community at Chithurst. He was known for having psychic powers, and he wasn't the slightest bit interested in meeting any of the monks, but he wanted to go to the lake because there was he was of the opinion there was a naga living in the lake, and he wanted to go and visit the naga. So Ajahn Sumedho was kind of, I wasn't there that day, but he was a bit surprised that he had this eminent monk visiting, and he sort of made a very cursory hellos and paid his respects at the house and the shrine room, and then said, can I go to the lake? There's a naga I want to meet there. So I'm not sure what the naga's doing with the silting up of the lake. But also Lake Manasarova in Tibet, where I was year before last, is supposed to be the place where Virupaka dwells. It's it's Lake Anuttata in the Pali scriptures, and it's also supposed to be the abiding place of the sort of chief Mahanaga and protector of the world. Whether he is there or not, I can't say. But I did request permission before I took some water from the lake to bring back for giving blessings here. Snakes can slough their skins and seemingly transform themselves, so the serpent is a figure of transformation. In sundry early religions, it acts as the intermediary between the earthly plane and the heavenly plane. The Buddha himself is sometimes referred to as the great Naga, Mahanaga. someone undergoing a journey of transformation from the worldly to the spiritual plane. And snakes and transformation are woven together because of the snake shedding their skin, leaving their skin behind. Here the serpent is used as a symbol of the practice of Dhamma, the transformation of the human mind as it applies itself to the realization of ultimate truth. Such an awakening deserves auspicious signs. So here the Naga has the figures of the sun and moon on its hood and wears a lotus as a crown. The sun and moon represent the polarities of rationality and mystical intuition or gnosis. The lotus is the crown of their union, enlightened wisdom that has the depth and sensitivity of gnosis and the analytical precision of rationality. Such is the fruition of the practice that is intimately related to the teaching. As it comes alive, the Dhamma sloughs off the old skin of habit and attachment that we have taken ourselves to be. Shedding one's skin can be alarming, but for those who are prepared for such an experience, the Buddha gave the following words. So, Sachin Sajito sort of delving into his spiritual symbolism. So, and you can see that on the right-hand side of the hood, there's the symbol of the sun, and then on the left-hand side, there is the moon. And then the lotus flower on top. So I think this is very beautifully put by Ajahn Sajito there in describing those different elements. So on the one hand, rationality, and the other, intuition. So the different sort of left brain, right brain, as they say. And then the lotus is the integration and harmonization of those two qualities. And as that quality comes to fruition, as he says, such is the fruition of the practice that is intimately related to the teaching. As it comes alive, so as the Dhamma comes alive, the Dhamma sloughs off the old skin of habit and attachment that we have taken ourselves to be. So as we practice the Dhamma and as that intuition and reason, say, work together, then it helps the mind to let go of its attachment and to particularly what I think I am, what you think you are, and the habits of self-view that accumulate. So shedding one's old skin, so leaving that old skin behind, as he says, can be alarming, but for those who are prepared for such an experience, the Buddha gave the following words. And then it leads into the Buddha's description of the two extremes, dveme bhikkhave anta, which we'll cover tomorrow. So before I open things up for questions, one other little point I'd like to make, which is kind of interesting, is that the discourses that the Buddha gave at Isipatana, this one, the Dhammacakka Sutta, and then the Anathalakkhana Sutta, as far as I'm aware, and we maybe got some other Pali scholars in the mix, as far as I'm aware, those are the only teachings that the Buddha ever gave in the area around Varanasi. That there's no ancient monasteries of Varanasi, no other sutta in the whole of the Pali canon says, you know, the Buddha was staying at Varanasi or the Buddha was staying at Isipatana. And it seems that, because Varanasi is very much like Hindu central, it's a sort of it's the epicenter of the Vedic world. And it seems likely that the Buddha, well, again, I'm second guessing the Buddha here, but it is curious that even though it was such a strong spiritual center, as was Ajahn Sajito was describing, that the Buddha, after that first rains retreat, he never went back there. He never established any monasteries there, and it seems like he never even visited. And which is curious, but then if you consider, well, if that's like the absolute center of the Vedic world, then it was highly likely that nobody was going to be interested in hearing what he had to say. Or the force of views and opinions about spiritual teachings would be so much towards the Vedic understanding of things that it's possible that he thought, well, there's no point going back there because no one's really going to listen. So he chose to spread his teachings in other areas. That's just supposition. But if anyone knows of any other sutta that, or any other occasion when the Buddha goes to Varanasi again, it'd be interesting to hear. But it seems that having been part of that group and part of the Vedic tradition, once he'd left that and struck out on his own, it's like, okay, once you've you're not a once you're not a Catholic anymore, you're not going to go back to the Vatican. It's like that's not going to be a receptive area, so no point going there. So anyway, that's just a speculation on my part, but it's a curious fact of the scriptures. So, anybody have any particular things they'd like to ask about or look for clarification? Yes.
Yes, I have a question. I've been having this question for a while. Like, what's the difference between a stream enterer, an arahant, fully enlightened being, and a bodhisattva? And what do you experience if you kind of fall into that, how do you say, category or? That's my question.
Okay. Well, I'm not very good at short answers. But I'll do my best. So there's a system of categorizing the obstructions to enlightenment that's called the 10 fetters. A fetter is like handcuffs. When you get arrested by the police, they get handcuffs or they put shackles on your legs. Those are called fetters, things that bind you, that tie you down. And so there is this list of the 10 fetters or samyojana. And so the four stages of enlightenment that are most commonly referred to throughout the teachings are categorized in terms of the presence or absence of those fetters. So the first three are self-view, sakkayaditti, the attachment to rules and conventions, religious forms and social conventions, which is called silapatta paramasa, and then vichikicca, which means doubt, particularly doubt about what is the path and what is not the path. So those three constitute the first three fetters. And so one who is a stream enterer, like yesterday we were talking about Kundanya, having that insight into all the subject to arising and subject to cessation. One who has reached who has entered the stream has broken those three fetters. So they've broken through self-view, through attachment to conventions, and they've got beyond doubt about what is the path and what is not the path. So that level of stream entry is something that in the scriptures, the Buddha speaks of quite regularly, and it's quite common. Many people become stream enterers, lay people, monastics, reach that level of liberation. And it's said that once someone has entered the stream, then there's a, according to Buddhist psychology, cosmology, there's a maximum of seven more lifetimes, and enlightenment is guaranteed. And the Buddha used this imagery. He reached down and scratched the ground and said, "What do you think is greater, the amount of dirt under my fingernail or the great earth?" And of course, the monk said, "Venerable sir, the amount of dirt under your fingernail is very small and the great earth is very large." And then he said, "So even so, in the same way, the amount of suffering that one who has made the breakthrough to stream entry is comparable to the dirt under my fingernail. The amount of suffering that one who has not made the breakthrough can expect to experience is comparable to the great earth." Another also very telling image he gave was that if you could make a deal whereby you would be skewered by 100 spears 3 times a day, in the morning, at midday, and at night time, every day for 100 years, but at the end of that 100 years, you're absolutely guaranteed to reach stream entry, then you should make that deal. If you do the sums, that comes to about 10 million skewerings. So, so it's a bargain. If you could be guaranteed stream entry, then that would be a bargain, because the amount of suffering that you would experience over so many lifetimes is far, far greater than being impaled by 100 spears 3 times a day. So that stream entry is the breaking through the first three fetters. Self-view being that belief, I am the body, I am the personality, this is who and what I am. This is an absolute, the feeling of self and the identification with those things is absolute. So then the next level is called a once-returner, or Sakadagami. And once-returner has broken through those first three fetters, but they've also reduced ill will and sense desire. So they haven't completely shed them or got beyond them, but the capacity to be to have ill will, negativity, aversion, or sense desire is softened, muted. And as the name suggests, once returner means they're guaranteed to they'll only return to the human realm once more, and their enlightenment will be guaranteed. Also, one who has reached the stream entry, going back to stream entry, one who has entered the stream, they can't be reborn in any of the lower realms. So they're seven lifetimes. They could be seven lifetimes as a human, but they can't be born as an animal or in the hungry ghost realm or in the hell realms. So they also use this term, like the doors to the lower realms have been closed. So then anagami means non-returner, so gami is to return, anagami is not return. So then someone who's reached the level of anagami, they have ended sense desire and ill will. So they an anagami can't get angry or doesn't feel sense desire. And so that an anagami, if you were an anagami and you passed away, then you would be reborn in what is called the Sudavasa, or the pure abodes. So this is very likely to be the basis of what's called Pure Land Buddhism, because the pure abodes, there's five Brahma realms that anagamis get reborn in. And it's said that during the great lengthy career of the Buddha as a bodhisattva, that they were the only realms he was never born in, because once you're born into the Sudavasa, then you're guaranteed to become an arahant in those realms. You can't fall out of them again. You can't sort of go down to a lower realm. So an anagami, I won't go into details, but there's various different grades of anagami. So some anagami, if you're a kind of a super-duper five-star anagami, then as soon as you're born in the Sudavasa, then you're enlightened immediately on appearance. So kind of, you become an arahant at birth. Then you have a long, long life as an arahant in this super Brahma realm. Other grades of anagami, then they have different lifetimes within that, within those Brahma realms, but they perfect they finish their work, spiritual training, and become an arahant in the Brahma realms later on in those lifetimes. And an arahant is one who has completely ended all greed, hatred, and delusion. So then they have broken the last five fetters. So far I've only spoken about the first five fetters. So then the last five are ruparaga, which is passion for material, for form. So it's to do with, say, attachment to blissful states of mind, states of concentration, blissful states that are associated with qualities of form. Then arupa raga, so that's attachment or obsession with blissful states of mind that are formless. And so there's still attachments, but they're subtle kinds of attachment. It's like the basic state of mind is very pure and noble, but it's still attached to those blissful qualities. Then the eighth one is called Asmi Mana. Asmi means I am. Mana is conceit. So the conceit of I am, Asmi Mana. So even though self-view has been let go of down at the stream entry level, that attachment to the body, attachment to the personality, even after the self-view has been let go of, then there can still be the feeling of I, which is not attached to the body or personality or any form or any particular quality, but still there's a feeling of I-ness and me-ness and minus. So asmi mana, and so that is the eighth one. Then the ninth one is udaccha, which means restlessness, and So this is not the restlessness of sitting in the temple at feeling like you're uncomfortable and you want to move at 45 minutes and it's still got a quarter of an hour to go. But it's a very subtle kind of restlessness. As I understand it, it's the restlessness of that something that's good or something that's real is over there. It's like it's there's a there-ness that the mind relates to as being real. That there's the mind still looks to something else to get to in order to be complete or to be peaceful or to be whole, to experience a finality. That there's that there's still a subject object. Even after the feeling of I-ness is let go of, there can still be that sort of subject object duality, and that there is more real than here, or there has got more promise, or is somehow something that sort of pulls the attention. so that there is there's still that quality of looking for something, looking for other. And then the last one is avijja, ignorance. So not seeing clearly. So the most subtle kinds of not seeing clearly. And so an anagami still experiences those five fetters to some degree or another. An arahant doesn't experience them anymore. So they've ended greed, hatred, and delusion. They've ended the conceit and restlessness and the whole bundle. As for bodhisattvas, well, there's different opinions. And it was probably not time to go into it here, but I did. I've read quite a number of different Buddhist traditions on this, so that depends who you read, and so that I think from the Theravada point of view, a being who is a bodhisattva is deliberately being reborn, so that a bodhisattva hasn't even reached stream entry. In their previous lifetimes, they're deliberately withholding their insight, or they're restraining themselves from developing that insight, so that they can keep being reborn and to develop the 10 perfections. That's supposed to be the short answer.
Thank you very much. I think it will take some time to digest it.
Yes. Yeah. But anyway, that's the basic. For there's in the book called The Island, Ajahn Pasno goes into quite a lot of detail about stream entry, and the point that he makes, which I think is extremely valid, is that we can get very idealistic, and in the West we tend to fixate on wanting sort of the bestest and the most and the kind of the top notch. And we think, well, I want to be an arahant, and stream entry, that's just kind of beginner's stuff. I mean, I want to. But the point that he makes is that it's in a way the wisest approach towards practice is rather to aim for stream entry, and to not set the goal too high, because then you just get disappointed and feel like a failure that you haven't made it. But if we take seriously not just what the Buddha says, but also the qualities that are embodied in stream entry, you realize, well, that in itself makes an absolute and crucial difference. And as the Buddha uses these symbols of, you know, that one who has made the breakthrough, the experience of dukkha is going to be like infinitely small compared to someone who hasn't. So that, don't belittle that, or don't look down on that. Anyway, so there's several, I think three or four chapters in The Island where Ajahn Pasno talks about stream entry and the different aspects of it. So I would recommend looking that up if you're interested. Maybe as a little follow-up to Chinta's question yesterday about whatever is subject to arising is subject to cessation. There's a famous verse when Sariputta, he and Moggallana were wanderers with a different teacher under the guidance of a teacher called Sanjaya. And it's said that Sariputta saw Asaji, one of the original five disciples walking through Rajagaha on his arms round, and he was so struck by the appearance, the demeanor of Venerable Asaji, that he was moved to stop him in the street and say, well, who are you? What kind of practice do you do? I mean, your face is so bright, your manner is so serene, your whole quality of your being is so peaceful. Who are you? What do you study? What's your practice? And then Venerable Asaji says, well, I'm just a disciple, you know, I'm just a follower. it'd be much better if you spoke to my teacher. And Venerable Sariputta says, well, we're here now, and I'd like to hear what you have to say. Please tell me what your teacher has trained you in, or what have you learned. And so then Venerable Asaji then says this little four-line verse, Ye Dhamma Hetu Pabhava begins. And it says, all things that spring from a cause, the Tathagata has described what that cause is, and he's also described their cessation as well. This is the teaching of the Mahasamana, of the great monk. And just by saying those words, then Sariputta becomes a stream enterer, and it describes it in the same way as Kandanya. He realized all is subject to arising, is subject to cessation. And then when he then reconnects with his friend Mahamoggallana, Moggallana sees him and says, wow, Sariputta, you look so bright, your face looks so radiant, so clear. Is it possible that you've found the deathless? And then Sariputta says, yes, indeed, friend, I have found the deathless. So in that respect, it's also that it's talking not just about arising and passing away, but also causality. That there's a reference to that, of all things that have a cause, the Tathagata has described what the cause is, and also their cessation, how they come to an end. And that verse has been very, very much used and quoted over the centuries, and on a number of the funerary urns, where the relics of the Buddha relics, also the relics of Venerable Sariputta and Moggallana, that those words are inscribed on the reliquary urn. So if you can see in the museum in Delhi, also at Sanchi, where there's a stupa with Sariputta's relics in Sanchi in India, these very, very old funerary urns, they've got that written in the Brahmi script, Ye Dhamma Hetu Pabhava, that verse. All things of those things that have arisen from a cause, the Tathagata's name what the cause is. So that's also something to reflect upon. It's not just arising and passing away, but also that quality of cause and effect. And also the last element to speak of in that respect is how it's by understanding cause and effect that we are able to awaken to that which is beyond cause and effect. Like it's a phrase Ajahn Chah used, and that it forms the title of a book, Taste of Freedom. The Thai version of that is called Nok Het Nirpon, which means Nok Het means outside of cause and beyond effect. And so that it's through understanding cause and effect, understanding the conditioned, that the mind is enabled to awaken to the unconditioned. And so those qualities are related in that way. So it's also something that's worth reflecting on, considering.